and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is February 25th, 2026, and this is episode 584. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, back in Western New York, just in time to get another snowstorm. And you're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnered and support the show. I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia, Italy. How you doing, John? I got a bottle of Puglia wine. I may have mentioned this before, but we have this really good like wine and spirit store in the neighboring town called Brighton. And they were kind of pushing some Puglia wine, and it's pretty good. It supposedly is very, if you're into wines at all, and I always had a big thing about grapes. It's the Puglia grape is apparently pretty much the same thing as the Zinfandel grape. So it is.
I can't even remember what Zinfandels look like.
Well, it's more about the. The flavor of the Zinfandel is very California-ish. I mean, I don't think it originally comes from California, but it's very identified with California. And I think it used to be considered kind of a lower class wine. And then people got into big, bold wines or something, and or wines with heavy tannins, as they say. So then it became, I think, kind of cool for a while. I don't know where it is now. I always liked them because I've just really always, my connection with grapes, I can't explain it. It is something almost religious, and it has been since my first memories. I just think they are absolutely magical.
Oh, you should definitely buy a farm in Puglia if you can.
Really?
Make some vines. Actually, I can't do much of that because I have gout. And I've had it for decades. And I also found that the hangovers were getting worse and worse. So I just stopped drinking altogether.
Yeah. I barely drink wine. It's funny. I love to eat grapes. And I've always have. Mm. But I don't really drink much wine anymore. So we'll get like a bottle and it'll take us a week to finish it usually. Wow. I don't
have that kind of discipline. I'll finish it. It may not be a good idea, but I'll finish it.
I agree. You know, the hangovers are just too hard. And I don't know. It's one of these things, well, at least with me, where you have to keep up with it. So like in Russia, I was drinking, when I look back, an enormous amount and too easily. The amount of whiskey I drank there and vodka, I don't know, and wine and whatever. But then I kind of got out of shape moving back to the U.S. People don't drink as much, especially the younger generations. They don't seem to really, which is good for them, you know. They're going to live longer probably. But they don't. Yeah. They're not really into drinking the way millennials.
I remember when marijuana worked on me. It was a brief period, but it was very nice. So, and it didn't knock you out as much as alcohol did. So if they prefer marijuana, good luck to them.
Yeah, I think that is part of it, that marijuana is available, but it's, you know, it's bringing its own problems. Marijuana is addictive. I knew a lot of people who are addicted to it. Whatever addiction means, it just means they can't stop using it, you know. I've known some younger people whose lives are kind of screwed up by how easily available it is. And people, even from when I was younger, friends of mine who got screwed up from pot. And I might say I was too, because I started it way too young. So it sort of messed up my brain development. Anyway, enough of my grape and drug yakking. How you doing otherwise?
Kind of nice. It's very peaceful here. And I can read the old science fiction novels that I never got around to, and I I do, and I found that some of them are just not readable, but some are strange and really valid, like Brian Aldiss, who's this lesser-known English science fiction guy. He wrote some good novels in a quiet way. They were too quiet for me. You know, when I was young, I wanted science fiction that was mainly bass drum. And, mm-hmm. you know, Philip K. Dick novels are good for that.
Did you happen to watch Trump's State of the Union address?
I read the New York Times summary of it. I cheated.
No, that's smart. I actually had it on the background for some of it. I'll say this. It was just boring. It was really boring. He's an absolute gas bag. But even compared to the one last year, the first one when he came back, you know, he had a lot of sort of pent-up vengeance, and here I am. And, and so he was admittedly pretty funny in that one. Like, you know, he still had his comedy chops. And now he's more it's just bragging. It's like a mixture of bragging and whining that all the problems that people think exist don't actually exist. But to the extent that they do exist, it's all the fault of the Democrats, but they don't exist because times have never been better or greater. But, you know, and it's just that back and forth. It's just
insufferable. It all seems like that. Like, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And I've read some excerpts from the speech, and they're probably transcribed accurately because the NYT is at least good for that.
Yeah.
And he's talking about, in this one, he's talking about General Dan Cain, who he says is a big fan of his, even though everybody else says Cain is kind of shrieking at, no, please don't!
But he really likes me a lot. He loves me a lot. He tells me that every day. I know he does.
But this is the excerpt that I saw. He has not spoken of not doing Iran. Okay, let me process that. Or even the fake limited strikes that I have been reading about. He only knows one thing, how to win, all caps.
Yes.
And if he is told to do so, he will be leading the pack. Everything that has been written about a potential war with Iran has been written incorrectly and purposefully so. That's the end of it. It's a good thing it
didn't get to him, these articles about what Cain was saying, you know.
Yeah.
It certainly hasn't got to Trump at all. No, sorry.
No, I mean, Iran is one of the few countries in the world that has a natural wall around it, and it's not so easy to get into.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're going to mostly talk about today, I think, right? I mean, it's a world of wars, but that is the war that is looming, and it's really hard to see how there isn't a war there, because how Trump gets out of it, you know, whether he wants to get out of it or not, how he gets out of not launching a major attack on Iran. I mean, they've just moved so many assets there. It would be extremely unusual to move that many assets, and not just, you know, not just the ships and the various planes that actually would be used to hit Iran, but all the support, all of the electronics, all of the jamming, you know, and the radar and everything. You can't move all that there and not actually act.
No, I mean, the only equipment that hasn't been moved in sufficient numbers is, as a recent New York Times article by some general, can't remember his name, said, troop movement.
Yes.
Machines, especially helicopters and those tilt rotor things.
Yeah.
V-22, I think.
Yeah, the Osprey. Yeah.
Yeah. So Trump, I mean, I would think, has enough sense, or somebody in his cabinet has enough sense to realize that when the U.S. tries an infantry operation in Iran, it's going to take casualties. And he probably can't face that prospect. So it's much easier to bomb the shit out of them. And
yep.
I mean, and why is he doing it? I don't know. I mean, I remember when he said, I'm going to end all these wars. I'm going to stop having wars of choice. And though I'm not much on conspiracy theories, it's kind of hard not to think now and then, like, was he being photographed down there on that island?
If you actually look at his campaign speeches, though, and this goes back to 2015, but also in 2024, I mean, he sold different versions of himself to different audiences. And he was able to sell himself as the anti-war candidate because Biden was dripping in blood.
Yes.
And loved it, you know? Biden embraced it, embraced that role. It was all he ever
wanted
to be. Well,
that's something else we should definitely talk about, that the DNC has now concluded what everybody else figured out months ago, that they lost the election because people like me refuse to vote for the Democratic Party as long as they were feeding weapons to help annihilate Gaza.
And what's incredible, so they've suppressed the report, the one autopsy that they did on Harris's loss. But yeah, it's leaking. Other reports are leaking out and they're trying to suppress it. The thing is that it isn't just that Biden, you know, went all in on the genocide, like with absolute enthusiasm, I mean, more in a weird way, more ideological enthusiasm than Trump. Trump didn't care for Palestinians at all. He clearly has the same racist, you know, loathing for Palestinians at least. But Biden's an actual, you know, a real committed Zionist and wanted to do everything for them. So that was one part of it. But the other part, I think, that hurt the Democrats was that neither Biden nor especially Harris would move one inch, not even an inch, to say, okay, you know, we'll throw you a few bones. We will meet you, you know, 1/1000th of the way, just to at least show that we hear you and not to completely fuck you off. They wouldn't do that, but it was absolutely bizarre. It was, the idea was like, if we give anything to these people who oppose genocide, they'll take a mile or something. I don't know what the hell they're thinking. But they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't even let an extremely squishy, very loyal Democrat who also was concerned about, you know, the genocide and kind of opposed it. They wouldn't let them speak for a minute inside the convention. I mean, they really went to all kinds of lengths, sending Harris with Liz Cheney, you know, to Michigan to tell the Arab community there, the Muslim community there, you know, where they stood. Like, it's that they really, like, rubbed it in, and that suppressed the vote.
The only thing I can think of is that they're like certain teams who are not really playing for their fans. They're playing for a small audience.
Yes.
Of donors in this case.
Yeah.
And maybe those donors don't want them veering away from that. Because really, everybody must have known in the DNC that the election was lost. And what they really wanted, I can only guess, is they wanted to keep their jobs.
Yes.
And they wanted to have a career in the Democratic Party. Woodwork.
Absolutely. Imagine it's a syndicate or a clan. And the clan is people in the party structure, think tank structure, the political consultancy, very lucrative and, you know, big business structure, and their donors that they are networked in with. And they don't, that is it. The most important thing is holding on to their sinecures, you know, maintaining the Klan's stranglehold over the party. And if I think they sort of think if had they won, had they moved in the direction more explicitly of saying, you know, policy's going to be different. We're going to, you know, come down a little harder on Israel. We're not going to send them arms. We're going to call it the genocide. And had they won with that, that would have empowered different people in the the general Democratic Party orbit. And that is much worse. Losing your power within this incredibly lucrative, powerful syndicate in the Democratic Party is much worse than losing to the other guy. You still keep your sinecures. I mean, the party's still there. So, yeah, they're...
Yeah,
they're,
I mean, in fact, they seem to preach in a smug and bitter way that you'll see. You'll vote for Trump, and then you'll see. And then we'll come back in glory to judge the living and the dead. I don't think so. I mean, it's because they have a strange inability to profit from any political moment. I mean, you look at the Senator Schumer from New York, Amy's uncle, and there is no more boring human being anywhere. I mean, the notion of him lashing out in any sudden speech that would become memorable, it's impossible. And you got to wonder what is he good at? There must be some skill within
fundraising donors.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got such deep tentacles in Wall Street, which is what the main base since Clinton's time for sure. I mean, it started a bit earlier, but that is the Democratic Party's donor base. And it was also Silicon Valley, but they've lost Silicon Valley. So they've started this whole abundance movement. So it's a movement of just like Ezra Klein and a couple of hacks in DC, plus lots and lots of money like Reid Hoffman and others. And the idea is really just to woo back Silicon Valley by saying, we're going to sell a progressivism that is all about deregulation and privatization, but it's progressive somehow because it's abundance for everybody. And
it seems like, you know, Elon Musk without the Kratom or whatever he's using. It's like
ketamine, I think, is his
ketamine.
Bag.
Yeah.
Anyways, but it is interesting to watch. So, you know, the party itself and the clan that's in control of the party, the syndicate that's in control, they're not going to like relinquish power because they're wrong. It's going to be like, this is like the end of it. I was wrong. I didn't listen. Yeah. No, they're actually blaming progressives or people on the left, blaming Arabs, blaming everybody else but themselves naturally because that's in their interest. So they're going to lose power most likely. It's very brittle, their hold on power, put it that way. Like, we talked about Maine, the kind of the insurgent Democrat candidate for Senate there, Graham Platner. This is the guy who's like, he's an anti-war populist. That's what he's running as. And he's this big burly guy who turned out he had a Totenkopf tattoo and he served with Blackwater. He's a mess, right? But in a sense, the fact that he's a mess, I mean, he has been pro-Palestine since his like high school yearbook people have found. So he has like, he has some,
nobody was. I mean,
nobody,
I remember
exactly.
That.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about the many problems with Graham Platner, but in a sense, because people are so genuinely disgusted and loathing of the party establishment, the systemic Democratic Party, that I actually think his totally fucked up nature, that he's like an anti-war guy who did four tours, you know, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, including with Blackwater, and has a Totenkopf, Nazi tattoo, that gives him, that shows that he's not part of the establishment, that he's not part of the system. And the fact that Schumer, Chuck Schumer.
It definitely shows that. Like, what shirts does he wear for job interviews?
But the guy is like, if he talked Nazi talk, then that would be a different story. He's clearly is just a mess. And this is a time for people with a mess because the party won't reform itself. And I have to say, he does say a lot of great things. I mean, unlike even Mamdani, unlike a lot of insurgent Democrats, unlike Bernie, for example, he's running against the Democratic Party. He's calling out Schumer by name. He's running against them. So they're putting against him the current governor. She's a Democrat, but her term ends. So they're running her against, she's the establishment candidate, against Plattner, so that, you know, for the Democratic nomination for Senate, and then they go against the incumbent, who's that forever been there moderate Republican, Susan Collins.
I couldn't even remember her name. Yeah. Even her name is too bland.
I know. Yeah, it's like Susan Collins. And she's been there forever. And, you know, and her whole thing is always like, is always to act kind of, you know, oh my Lord, about anything, you know, any Democrat or any Republican, I'm sorry, you know, Trump says or whatever. But then when it comes to voting time, she always votes, you know, pretty much down the line with Trump or Bush or whatever. Mm. But anyway, she's presumably vulnerable. And so the Democratic Party, Schumer has come in, like they brought in all the big guns to back up Janet Mills, the governor, to destroy Graham Plattner, who's like an oyster farmer. And really like planted the story about the Totenkopf tattoo, which they found in some old Facebook post, you know, and he had it removed and whatever. And I think that really only helped him. But anyway, the latest poll for the primary, which will be coming up soon, has Plattner leading Mills by 38 points.
Wow.
Like completely destroying her. And then in the general, according to the polls, he's leading Susan Collins by, I think, 10 or 11 points, whereas Mills is in a statistical tie with Collins. So I mean, this just gives an indication of kind of how brittle the Democratic Party is. If somebody would just come in and say the party is the problem rather than just Donald Trump is obviously a problem. Everybody in the Democratic Party agrees with that. That's not the issue. The problem is the party itself, which has handed power through its failures to the worst candidate in history twice. That's where the problem is, you know? And that's what this guy keeps saying. So he's good in that way. He's not like, he's not the savior. He's got problems. A guy who volunteered for Blackwater in Afghanistan is not going to be the person who saves us. He could turn out to be another one of these fucking Fetterman types. But it does send sends a good message to shatter the Democratic
Party. Yeah, 38 points, even in a primary, is astonishing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So you have that. And then you have on the other side, so like there was an election recently, a couple weeks ago, a primary in New Jersey for a congressional seat. And there was sort of the DSA-type candidate, you know, the left progressive, Ana Lilia Mejia, I think her name is how you pronounce her name. And she was kind of an insurgent running against Tom Malinowski, who's kind of like, I would say more like a center-left Democrat, you know, pretty powerful within the party. But he made the mistake of, and this may explain a little bit of where the Harris people are coming from. He made the mistake of holding out the possibility that Israel's gone too far and that we need to make sure that they're, you know, adhering to U.S. law on arms sales, because according to U.S. law, you cannot ship arms to a country that's committing human rights violations and war crimes. So that's why Blinken was suppressing all those reports and killing them all, because
he's one of that dwindling community that still believes there are rules here.
Yes, he's kind of like that, and he was doing that clearly because he understands where the especially primary base voters are. So you have to at least throw a bone. So AIPAC went in, and whereas his opponent, Mejia, is, you know, more like Mamdani, you know, very pro-Palestine and all that. But AIPAC did an interesting thing, and people are saying, oh, AIPAC made a mistake. I don't think so. They went in and spent millions destroying Malinowski, and they destroyed him, and he lost to Mejia, who's the, you know, the pro-Palestine left DSA candidate. So she won the primary, barely. And I think the message was really clear that AIPAC, that if you're anywhere within the establishment, if you step one toe outside of it, that you're going to be destroyed. And they don't care who comes in after that, because they don't have anything to do with the far left of the party.
They've never owned the progressive wing of the party, but they do own effectively the center wing. And, well, that would make a weird bird, but the center. Yeah. And they're going to destroy anybody who gets out of it.
Yeah. And so that's kind of interesting to watch. And that's all part of the whole rot of the Democratic Party. And I mean, as you said, like, the Democrat, there is no opposition to Trump's war. Trump has not done shit to sell this war at all, just as he didn't do anything to sell, you know, last year's bombing or the kidnapping of Maduro. Like, it was just, actually, with the kidnapping of Maduro, I think it put in, you know, maybe a week or two's worth of lies to get people kind of on board with that. But This is shaping up to be a pretty major attack, and they just haven't even bothered. And there is
the only visible opposition is the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who keeps screeching that Iran is not Venezuela, and this is not going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, I think the Democrats, Schumer and Jeffries and the whole syndicate, I think their view is generally they support the war. They support anything that helps Israel. So they support the war, and they would like Trump to... They think, though, that it probably won't go well. So they don't want to come out and be on record as opposing anything that might help Israel. But they also think it's going to go bad for him, probably, as the Joint Chiefs do. And so they'll reap the... I mean, the strategy for the Democrats is to do nothing and win. And that they think will validate and kind of, validate and like re-empower the completely discredited, you know, centrist establishment of the party in their minds.
It's very similar to what happened across the Atlantic, where Starmer actually did take advantage of the fact that the Tories were not even so much despised as everybody was just tired of them. They'd been in there for a really long time. And British voters have more of a temper than Americans do. Like, you know, the Brexit vote was like that. Like, they all just said, fuck you. Yeah, so Starmer has been stumbling around like a drunk in a dark room, and he obviously doesn't know what he's doing, sucking up to everybody, occasionally sucking up even to the really abhorrent nativist majority, as well as sucking up to Trump and...
Yeah,
the U.S.
I'll never forget when he scrambled around on the street to pick up Trump's papers that Trump dropped. That to me is
Trump. Yeah. Don't bother. I don't need him.
There's Chamberlain holding up the piece of paper, and there's Starmer scrambling around for the papers on the ground. Yeah, England in 100 years. Come a long way, baby.
So it's weird that. I mean, these parties tend to imitate each other. And the more they imitate each other, the more they do so when they're stumbling around and being complete idiots. That's what they like, because it seems to make for a, well, a kind of peace within the donor class. Like that's what's really at stake here.
Yeah. Yeah. Starmer, it's pretty stark. His yeah. poll number, I think his approvals are, you know, around 20%. What's interesting there is that, so there's a by-election coming up. The Greens are, because Britain has, although Britain has as little or maybe less even, I don't know, in some ways, democracy as the U.S. does. I mean, we're both like imperial oligarchies with sort of limited democracy. One thing Britain does have is it's a lot more possible to have third parties there. It's structurally almost impossible to have a third party, a real, like an actual, genuine, viable third party at the federal level and even pretty much at a lot of state levels in this country. It's just structurally how it is. It was designed that way by the Republicans and Democrats really in response to the populist threat in the late 19th century. And the populists were breaking both parties' stranglehold. And so the two parties came together. And it was, you know, it was basically a counterinsurgency strategy, including, you know, imposing Jim Crow laws to divide up blacks and whites again because they were coming together under the populists and really just making it legally all but impossible to get a third party going. And in Britain, you can. So this by-election's coming up and in Britain, and the Greens are polling, I think Greens are polling number one right now.
They are. Yeah, I checked this afternoon, and it's close, but they're still number one. And
and then Reform is two, right? The Farage's party.
Reform is definitely two. It's like 3% or something behind the Greens. But also, newspapers seem to be a much bigger factor in the UK. And there were several venomous articles in the Daily Mail on Zach Polanski, who's the leader of the Greens and a more or less pro-Palestinian Jewish candidate, which drives them really crazy. It's a very vindictive campaign with anybody who is Jewish and supports the Palestinians in the British press anyway. Mm-hmm. And
same thing in Germany, weirdly enough. Boy, do they go after Jews who are pro-Palestine hard.
Wow.
And they're like, we know, we committed the Holocaust, so we have the moral authority to say you, Jew, are an anti-Semite. It's the craziest.
So that's where you get your moral
authority
from? Yes,
I'm not joking.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah, so there's a, we'll try to get off this and get back to Iran, but I did see just this morning, so there's this by-election, and the Green Party candidate, this isn't Polanski, but, you know, this is a party, of course. You were saying that he's getting smeared as probably an anti-Semite, right? That's how they destroyed Corbyn. That's how I mean, you know, we actually need to do an episode just on Britain because there's a lot going on there. This whole scandal with with this guy McSweeney, who's kind of the fixer who put Starmer in power. And I don't know if you followed any of these scandals. Like,
he just got dismissed, didn't he?
Yeah, because he had paid. Basically, I think the Sunday Times was doing an investigation or following up on another reporter's investigation into some kind of like donor corruption scandal. And so McSweeney hired a PR firm basically to do like a Trump P-tape dossier, but on a bunch of reporters, including, our friends at Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, and tarring them as Russian agents to spread Russian disinformation because they were onto a real story of an actual like legal violation by Starmer's Labour in the election. And so, and then they took that information to GCHQ to try to get, you know, the spy aid, the British spy agency, to spy on these reporters. And I think, you know, everyone would have been fine if it was Max Blumenthal or some other independent reporters. I think Matt Kennard maybe was on the list. But the problem was going after Murdoch's people at the Sunday Times. These are made men in the British media world. And so that scandal is kind of breaking. And I think there are other scandals. Of course, the fact that Starmer appointed Mandelson, who was all over the Epstein files with photos and everything. Everybody knew it when he appointed him. I remember there was such an outcry. But now that with the latest Epstein release, it's just, it's made it impossible for them to ignore Mandelson anymore. And now they're saying, well, wait a minute, why did Starmer appoint him when everybody already knew this problem existed? So he's sinking under there's a lot going on in Britain.
His only defense was, well, somebody told me to.
Yes, exactly. I think McSweeney, who just had to resign or something, you know, told me to, but that's pretty pathetic. And his numbers are in the tank. So anyway, so there's this by-election and Labour is, I think, so the Greens are like 30%. Reform is like 28% and Labour's like 27% in this particular by-election. And I just saw that Labour is putting out this like panic, you know, this sort of five-alarm scare their voting base, saying it shows a poll and it says Reform is tied with Labour, and it shows like a bar graph with Reform and Labour and each at like 28%. If you want to prevent, you know, fascism from coming to power, your only hope is to vote for Labour. So what they're doing is they're pretending that Greens aren't actually winning, because the only hope actually to defeat fascism there is to vote Greens. A vote for Labour is a vote for fascism, like by that mentality. So they're having to actually pretend the Greens don't exist, even though they're number one in the polls. Wow. And that's...
I think I've seen other hit pieces probably by Green sympathizers who say, with some truth, I would imagine, that in a quiet way, Labour is desperate for reform to win that election. Mm-hmm. Because, it's much like what we talked about with the Democratic Party. Reform is, it's Farage. It's a lunatic party. Mm-hmm. And it probably won't last very long. He'll have to come up with another name for a party when he pops up again. But they don't want anybody who's becoming what they refuse to be. Mm-hmm. And that would be Labour.
Yeah. Crushing the left. And the British, the way they crushed Jeremy Corbyn and Labour's brief fling with Corbyn, it was a very popular and populist moment. And man, it's scary. It's pretty scary how they did it. Like the Democratic establishment crushed Bernie in a different way, because Bernie never really wanted to take on the establishment. He wanted to change them. He wanted them to start talking about things that they won't talk about, but he never ran against them. He never said, you're the problem. He was saying, you need to listen to this.
It's a shame, actually.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He was never in it to win it. I mean, there's no other way to put it. He was never in it to win it the way Trump was in it to win it in 2015. And he won it by going after the Republican Party and smashing right through it. Bernie never wanted to do that. The energy was there, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted to make it a little better. But Corbyn actually took power. And so the way they took him down, it was obviously using anti-Semitism in order to destroy him, but also in order to purge the party and take control of it. I mean, this is what Trump's doing. Trump and the Heritage Foundation use anti-Semitism to purge. This is... It's really dark stuff.
But I remember I read a lot of British papers, and they were very, very happy with Starmer when he got rid of Corbyn.
Yes.
And he was just the bright-eyed boy. They even picked better-looking photos of him than they pick now, because
yes.
now he looks like a fat-faced guy who's lost his plane ticket or something.
Yeah.
Back then, he was a smart, you know, horn-rimmed go-getter.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a square jaw, and now he has a butt face. I mean, it's really weird. I don't know how they did that, but they did it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's one of these days we should do a kind of what the hell's – I don't know. There's yeah, a lot going on.
I think the one interesting development – that aside from the coming invasion that we haven't talked about yet is that astonishing interview that you sent me originally, the Tucker Carlson.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, Mike Huckabee, yeah.
Mike Huckabee. By the way, how could you possibly be named Huckabee? It sounds like a burger stand in Happy yes. Days or something.
Yes, come to Huckabee's. Burger, yeah. Fries, and a milkshake, yeah. Yeah, and he has that kind of look. He's got that sort of like, I don't know, like puppetoon chin. You know? From those old Christmas puppetoons. He's kind of... So, yeah, that was... I don't know what else you were thinking about that interview, but the Christian Concern trolling.
Yeah.
You stab your opponent. Well, mostly it was Tucker stabbing Huckabee. And then you pull back and say, but as a Christian... I don't hate anybody. I love everybody. I'm sure you do too, because I'm a Christian. You're a Christian. You know?
I didn't see any evidence of any concern for the many dead Palestinians in Huckabee's responses. But also, he changed with Carlson. Like, for 20 minutes or so, he seemed to assume he was among friends. And then... Mm-hmm. Far too late. He started getting defensive.
Yes.
And noticed that Carlson was beating the shit out of him.
Yeah. I think, you know, now that you mention it, when you ask why do these people that clearly are, that Tucker has it in for them, I think what sparked it is, you know, there are people that are saying, Tucker is a people on the right accusing him of anti-Semitism, and Huckabee is part of that crowd. And I think so that got Tucker pissed off at Huckabee. I think they've known each other for a long time, so Tucker decided to have his debate. Like on the right, they really love having their debates. That was Charlie Kirk's thing, you know. And Tucker's very good at these debates. And I think it's just vanity. I think Huckabee, these people must be incredibly vain. Huckabee exists in a world that it's like a rock star. I mean, I wouldn't want his stardom. God knows. I have
that really, really blows me away. Like, you want that kind of stardom?
I know.
I mean, God, I'd rather be in a boy band than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like being known as the most famous used car dealer, you know, in the world. Like, okay. So, but so it must just been a vanity and Huckabee thinking, when he sees me, I'll melt him. Something. And he won't. And that was one thing Tucker, I thought, was so good at, that Tucker would constantly make like he's being melted because he's good and he follows Christ, and Christ loves everyone, and so does Tucker. But then you said this. What do you really like?
Yeah, and I think, I think I've I've seen him with enough Iraq cheerleaders to think there's some truth in his claim that he's mainly just trying to keep the U.S. out of another disastrous war.
Yeah.
That, you got to hit hard to do that, and he did.
I mean, it is a nationalist position. If you were a nationalist, why would you want to go to war basically for Israel?
Because, let's not ignore the obvious. Iran defeated Iraq in spite of the fact that Iraq had massive help from U.S. satellites.
Poison gas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arms caches from weird deals with Central American throat slitters, everything. And they still won. Iran is no joke. And I think that's what a lot of people are trying to tell Trump and his minions. But once again, they're assuming, by the shape of the invasion package, I would say they're assuming that it's going to be something where no foot that isn't in the special forces touches the ground.
Yeah.
Lots of missiles, lots of aircraft blowing the hell out of Iran. Of course, you know, pilots get shot down.
Yes.
And you can't count on that.
Yes. Yep. I remember, you know, among the various humiliations, speaking of Iran, that happened in Lebanon to Reagan in the mid-80s, were the Navy pilots that were shot down.
Right.
By the Syrians.
Yeah, it was on A-10, and that has a crew of two. So.
Yeah. And Jesse Jackson had to go out and rescue them, which was especially humiliating for Reagan.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about the package and all this stuff. There was a report in a Washington, you know, pure arms industry think tank, but still has useful information, just know where it's coming from. CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, it's very deeply tied in with Pentagon and the whole national security establishment. But anyway, they've just produced something that gives a sense of, you know, what's actually out there. And it's not a force for an invasion, that's for sure.
Right.
There are two aircraft carriers out of 11. I want to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Mm. A total of 18 ships in the I guess we call them the battle
groups.
Yeah,
but not 90 strike aircraft on the ships.
So. Yeah, 90 plus. Yeah. I mean, exactly, 90 plus. Then they moved in a bunch of aircraft. And again, you know, these are estimates because we don't know exactly, and stuff could be hidden, but they moved in over 30 F-30. This is the Air Force has also moved in over 30 F-35s, over 10 F-22s. I think the F-22 just made its debut. Its one and only combat mission, as far as I know, was a couple of years ago when there was that Chinese balloon floating around.
Oh.
And Biden called in an F-22 to blow it to smithereens.
Confirmed kill.
Yes. You remember, did you have to see that movie when you were in grammar school about the French kid with the red balloon and the black and white everywhere?
Yeah, the red balloon.
It's called the red balloon, okay. Yeah, so it's like Biden-era red balloon. It's like, oh, je m'appelle François, je ne sais pas le rouge balloon. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Anyway. They were too stupid back in those days. They didn't even recognize the security threat.
30 plus F-16s. So I would imagine there's even more. 30 plus F-15Es, some A-10s, which is kind of strange. I know that they've brought in a lot of AWACS planes. In fact, I think through the Chinese open source satellite company, they just published this morning some photos, satellite photos of, I think it's like Prince Bandar's air base, which is one of those American air bases, and there were a whole bunch of American AWACS there.
That's typical Trump. Like, I'm gonna let my ambassador insult you and sort of deny the very right to the land you have. And by the way, could I park the strike aircraft?
Yeah, I know. That's a real issue here because they're moving all of these air assets there, which means that they're all making themselves, all of these countries hosting them, which presumably would be Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE and Kuwait and Bahrain, would make them potentially targets for an Iranian missile strike. And I don't, you know, we were getting reports that the Arab countries, the Gulf countries, were saying they didn't want to have anything to do with this. But then I heard a report, you know, maybe this, there's so much planted disinformation as well, just that a day or two ago, somebody was arguing that actually the Saudis and the UAE now favor it. I really have my doubts.
Yeah, they probably favor in theory taking out Iran, but most military observers mm-hmm. say this is not an invasion force that can land troops and take territory. So you're not going to destroy Iran. At most, you're going to do yet another eroding strike, you know. Mm-hmm. And Trump said his most recent strike on Iran in the days of the Palestinian war totally destroyed their nuclear capability. And nobody seems to have noticed that. Then why are we killing it again?
I know. Yeah. I know. That's. I think somebody tried to call them out on that because, yeah, Trump, like you can screenshot the release from last June that Trump said he had set back the nuclear program for at least a generation. It was done. It was obliterated, I think was the word he used. And now 6 months later, but we have to go back in and re-obliterate it or something. The force is comparable, according to CSIS, and I think it makes sense, to Operation Desert Fox. If you remember when the Monica Lewinsky scandal first broke big, I think it was the end of 1998. Yeah. Clinton, the first thing he did, I think it was like on the first day of deliberations and for the impeachment, he just opened up on Saddam Hussein on Iraq and just sent a huge sort of air and aerial and cruise missile bombing attack on Iraq.
Iran is not Iraq.
I know.
It's a very formidable country, and people tend to become more patriotic. They sort of circle the wagons and say, oh, well, okay, after all, I'm an Iranian, and you can't do this. So I don't know. I guess if you're Trump and you're getting advice from all the generals that this is a bad idea. He talks a lot about death lately. Maybe mm-hmm. he just wants to get something started in there and then.
Yeah. The gerontocracy wants everyone to go with them. It's like mummies getting buried with their cats. The cat's like, I don't want to die.
But I think it really is.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
Yeah. Let's try and make a little sense of it. Trump, because it does seem confusing, he said that he wants to bomb because of the nuclear program or maybe because of the ballistic missiles, which turned out to be such a grave threat to Israel, or to help the protesters, which already got crushed. And we all know Trump doesn't give a fuck about protesters anywhere.
Right.
But I think the most plausible explanation, if Trump bombs again, is the same goal that the Israelis had, I think, in the 12-day war, which is regime change, which is to somehow collapse the regime using old faulty intelligence. You know, if you look back at that again, I mean, the Israelis carried out operationally, at least. I mean, it was an amazing, as often is the case with them, it was an amazing operation in terms of they assassinated and killed a lot of people. They caused a lot of damage. They took out a lot of air defense systems. But, if you look back at that, like Israel has, it succeeded in really taming Hezbollah, which was massive. Mm-hmm. It got Assad, it played a big role in seeing Assad overthrown. I'm not sure how completely happy now that they are with Jolani because of his ties to Turkey. And, the Israelis are already talking about Turkey's the next enemy after Iran.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but at least they did get rid of Assad. Like, it looked like everything was going their way, roughly. And, of course, they're, loving their genocide in Gaza. But the Iranian war, when you look back on it, even though they did cause an enormous amount of damage to Iran, they didn't achieve anything. And in fact, the war was going bad for them in those last couple of days. They pretty much had
some
to
of those
rescued.
Strikes on Tel Aviv were stunning. And you could really tell the difference between the early salvos of dumb missiles and the later salvos of very smart missiles with what do they call it? Inertial evasion techniques. Mm. Like, you know, you get down near the ground and then you dart.
So they can't be hit head on, which is the best way to hit them. So it didn't go well. They were running very low, they and the Americans, on crucial gold-plated, you know, anti-missile system missiles. And from what I'm hearing, although obviously the Israelis are dying for Trump to do this, they're not themselves sure that they want to be involved in it because it didn't really go that well for them the last time. Like, they gave it their all and succeeded, you know, in a lot of their, probably their initial goals of killing this person, taking out this, that, and the other. But they didn't achieve anything with it. And eventually they were getting hit so much that they had to get bailed out. So
in fact, not Smotrich, but what's the other guy's
Ben-Gvir.
Ben-Gvir actually threatened to go after any Israeli citizen who published any details about where the missiles hit.
So if Trump is going to bomb them, the only goal imaginable that I can think is either it's a big bombing as a demonstration in the hope that it doesn't get out of control. And then whatever deal is made after that, he can say, this deal happened because I bombed the shit out of them, which is possible. But the problem here, but I think really the goal is, if you're having a real goal here, the Americans, it's regime change. Nothing else really makes sense.
Well, I think it's regime change and a surge of patriotism that will drive thoughts of Trump's misbehavior in whatever area.
Epstein.
Out of people's
and
heads.
And failures, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, his polling numbers are now like the lowest in history. He's polling so poorly because of the economy. People are already sick of hearing him. And, you know, again, like at his State of the Union address, he knew that he was supposed to say something about how people are hurting and they can't afford stuff. And it's true. I mean, he cut subsidies for health insurance premiums. So, like, ours doubled. Tens of millions of Americans' healthcare premiums have doubled or tripled, or they just gave them up because it's unaffordable because of since January. He just did that, but he's bragging about all the money he's spending on the military. Look, and Trump is also coming off a string of foreign policy, I think he would say, successes. I mean, the operation to kidnap Maduro went, from Trump's point of view, it went pretty cleanly well for now, so far. The circumstances are very different for a lot of reasons. Venezuela's nearby. They clearly had people on the inside. It's a very different
regime. They had a whole clique of wealthy people on their side.
Yeah,
I don't think Iran has anything like that. They have probably people with wealth, but people of that class who are also very, very fierce ideologues in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, put it this way, if they did, this would not even be possible, as we saw in 1980, but if the U.S. was even able to do a special forces operation, flying helicopters and stealth, whatever, into Tehran and kidnap Khamenei, for example, that would change nothing. I mean, that, it's very different. Like, that would not bring them to heel. Iran has a real deep state. I mean, I read these books by Michael Agsworthy, and I asked around among people who know Iran much better than I do, and they spoke very highly of him too. And there are aspects of it that, of the Iran that he described, the IRI Iran, that is, of their deep state, that really kind of reminded me of Russia, Right. It's not just one guy at the top, and it's not, it's just not nearly as brittle in that way. It's a huge country, you know, three times the size of Iraq, almost 100 million people, a massive ballistic missile arsenal.
He came down too hard, darn it, on the Manichaeans. I like them Manichaeans, and he hated them for some reason.
In his larger history book.
Yeah.
So, and also the other thing is, like with Syria, for example, where they got a regime change. Trump, by the way, just bragged a few days ago in a press conference that he put Shara in. I don't know. So that he put Shara into power. He said, I did that, by the way. He's a tough guy. He's no choir boy, but you know, you can't be. But I know. But so I bring this up also because the New York Times ran a story, one of these classic like Bush era propaganda stories, that Iran could activate terrorist groups in the US and Europe, including Al Qaeda. And it's like, so wait, you're saying Trump just admitted we put Al Qaeda's, you know, the head of Al Qaeda in Syria, in power in Syria, but Iran, which fought Al Qaeda all these decades, is going to activate Al Qaeda to the extent it even exists outside of Syria anymore. I guess Al Qaeda exists in Africa. It's big in Africa.
Yeah, it's big in the Sahel, they always say. But, you know, being big in the Sahel, it's not the most dynamic part of the world.
It's also not going to be, it's not where they're going to hit the U.S. in the Sahel.
Yeah.
You know, there was that interesting, I don't know if you saw this, Witkoff was on one of the Sunday Newsmaker programs, and this people think is kind of a window into the thinking of Trump's people, which is he said, Witkoff says, I'm going to quote him here, I don't want to use the word frustrated because he, Trump, understands he's got plenty of alternatives, but he's curious as to why the Iranians haven't, I don't want to use the word capitulated, which means he wants to use the word capitulated, but why haven't they capitulated? Why, under this sort of pressure, with the amount of sea power and naval power that we have over there, why haven't they come to us and said, we profess that we don't want a weapon, so here's what we're prepared to do? You know, Trump's really big on, you make a show of capitulating. It's very, you know, Roy Cohn mafia.
Yeah.
You make a show of capitulating and then you can survive and you can have your dirty deals together. But it means a lot. It does mean that you have submitted to the emperor a certain level of certainly public power. And so Witkoff laments, he says, and yet it's hard to sort of get them to that place to capitulate publicly. And that's not going to happen. And, you know, the Iranians, so Trump on his side is like, look, I have established credible madman theory. And he has, you know, but the Iranians aren't playing along. This isn't how it's supposed to work. So now what? Now I'm going to have to bomb them. But but from the Iranian point of view, you know, the Iranians, this goes back to Khomeini in the 80s. Like, the Iranians have never wanted to to get into a direct kinetic war with the U.S. because the U.S. is more powerful, is bigger, the military is stronger. They want to have, ideally, you know, irregular warfare and low-intensity warfare.
I mean, I'm not saying the entire Iranian population. I mean, I don't really know, but a large part of the Iranian leadership really does have some doomsday, very Shia thought patterns in its head. And they would love, I suspect, not everybody, but many of them would love to get U.S. troops on the ground and kill one for every 10 that the Americans kill. And that would make them quite happy.
Yeah, that would. And I do think Trump is not, and the people around him are not stupid enough. I mean, look at what Trump has done so far, right? He killed Soleimani, and that was a success. And the Iranians only responded, and that was a huge, like that is an irreplaceable, you know, as they would say, chess piece. Like that was actually an irreplaceable talent that really hurt them. And they only responded in it with a demonstrative kind of a performative strike. It was a real strike. It showed that their missiles are serious, but they did not set out to kill Americans and to let it escalate. And then Trump, you know, bombed them with the B-2 bombers during the 12-day war, in part, it seems like, to help provide cover for Israel to end it, because Israel needed to get out of the war, and in part to, you know, gloat. And the Iranians only responded, again, with a kind of performative strike on a base in Qatar. Nobody was really hurt, again. And that had been the Iranian response, you know, in general, until the 12-day war, I think, with Israel. The Iranians also had not wanted to get into really a direct fight with Israel, but the 12-day war, they had to. So they started showing what they could do to Israel. And I think, you know, again, if you remember with the 12-day war, Trump had Witkoff and Kushner, again, heading out to negotiate with the Iranians, having them think that the negotiations were actually really moving forward. Things were going well. They were moving to the next level. And then it turned out to just be cover so that Israel could launch a very effective surprise attack, that decapitation strike that took out, you know, a dozen general level commanders and, you know, half a dozen or more nuclear scientists and so on. So the Iranians are at a point now where it's like, well, if we're negotiating with them based on what we've seen, and he bragged about it because he can't shut up, he's probably got something else up his sleeve, number one. Number two, if we do another performative response, it's not deterring. It's not providing any deterrence. Like, they bomb us, we do a performative strike because we don't want it to escalate. It just leads to another strike 3 to 6 months down the line. So there's a lot of talk in Iran, apparently, from what I'm reading, and this makes absolute sense, that actually for deterrence, we have to move to the next level. We have to actually show that we can cause real harm. We have to take that chance.
Yeah, there was an article in the, I think the Telegraph, which is a very right-wing paper. In fact, it was by that correspondent who got shot and crippled in Riyadh maybe 10 years ago. Mm. And it was odd because it was a preview of the American attack, the contemplated attack on Iran. And he said there are seven possibilities. He started with the least scary. Mm-hmm. So number one was basically that everything is going to go fine. And at the very end of that, he said, quote, "This is a highly optimistic scenario."
Is this a scenario where they say, "I capitulate, Iran capitulate," to Witkoff, basically? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the second one is that Iran gets hurt and it goes, ow, and it doesn't do anything. And at the end of that option, he said, again, this is at the optimistic end of the scale. And then he finally started dealing with the very scary possibilities. And on the fourth option, he said, his little comment on it was, this is highly likely.
So what happens in that one?
Iran obliterates everything along the Persian Gulf, in and beyond its borders.
So it sets it all alight, right? Like they've said, basically. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, it came out, I didn't remember this story from breaking when it first broke last summer. But I went back and found it. According to U.S. officials, anyway, they say that during the 12-day war, towards the end of it, actually, Iran was making preparations to mine the Straits of Hormuz. And mining the Straits of Hormuz would be, I would imagine would not just be about laying mines, although that would be part of it, but that would be part of a larger strategy of setting the region on fire like that. And this, again, you know, let's remind people again, it's always good to remember about the Straits of Hormuz. This is this very narrow shipping passageway that goes between, well, it's basically like United Arab Emirates and Oman. Oman kind of has this exclave. And then on the southern side and Iran on the northern side, it's very narrow. At its narrowest point, it's about 20, 25 miles. And something like 20% of the world's liquefied natural gas, mostly from Qatar, goes through there. And 25% or more of the world's oil passes through there. So this, there is no choke point like this in the world, really, for
energy. No, it really seems designed by a sadistic game designer.
Yes. Yeah, how are you going to do? Yeah, square this. So it's, and it, that means it's a leverage point. It's a real leverage point. And just today, I saw that reports that Iran was holding exercises on a couple of these islands. We'll post a map here, but if you look at a map of the straits, there are islands like Abu Musa, Tumba al-Kubra. These are islands that are right there in the middle of the actual shipping lane that Iran holds, that I think the UAE kind of claimed some of it, but you know they can't really do anything about it. Iran could just cause a lot of serious chaos there. They were preparing their various speedboats and other aquatic, you know, vehicles with mines. And they apparently have, you know, thousands and thousands of mines that they could lay there. And all you would need to do is have a couple ships blow up. And that would be it for a long time. It would be absolutely disastrous. And again, you know, Trump yesterday was, he was trying his hardest because he had been told over and over, I'm sure, to acknowledge that there's an affordability problem in this country. And there really is, except for people in the kind of upper 15-20%, let's say. But then he just sunk back to him. But this word affordability, I never heard it before. It's a plot by the communist, the left-wing radicals in the Democratic Party. You know, talk about sending inflation through the roof. If they actually cut that off, and that would be, I mean, it would seem to make sense. It would seem that if you're out, I mean, just think of this not in terms of what is the moral, historical, revolutionary thing for Iran to do, you know, against the empire or to defend the Palestinian people or to fight imperialism, but what is the, let's say, I hate this word, but what is the regime's self-interest here is to protect itself and the state the best way possible. And it would seem to me that you would, at this point now, after all this, you would have to demonstrate that you can cause real harm. You wouldn't want to put all your cards out, but you do have to demonstrate the way they did to the Israelis. You would have to demonstrate you can cause real harm and then it can get even a lot worse.
This is where you want a serious intelligence service that marks every possible target and has a list somewhere of good targets, easy to hit, would do a lot of harm. And I'm sure the Iranian intelligence apparatus, which is pretty formidable, would have many lists like that. So this is when you activate them.
Yeah. So this big-time think tank, another one of these, you know, neocon think tanks, the FDD, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, I believe this one was literally born out of AIPAC to be just purely a, you know, defense, as they call it, or war now, think tank. Yeah, so they published this map of really Iran's key economic infrastructure that the FDD, this basically a pro-Israel think tank, is recommending Trump do bomb. And this would actually cause major harm to Iran. It would be hard for the IRI to govern Iran if its economy was destroyed like this. You know, ports, refineries, energy zones. It would cause a lot of harm. So it would make sense that they would want to forestall that by showing that they could create pain themselves. The Iranians could also create pain. I think it's interesting to note here that Iran also in the last 6 months to a year has been apparently, now, you know, again, this is wartime reporting, so you never know, but it looks like they've been cutting arms deals with Russia and China, and I don't know when these arms would be delivered. But some of these systems, it's kind of interesting to note here. For example, Iran apparently has bought these Chinese radar and sensor systems, including something called the YLC-AB radar system, which can detect stealth, according to the Chinese. And I think as we saw in the Pakistan-India war, the Chinese weapons work pretty well so far as what yep. we've seen. And you know, we see this with every electronics that we have that we're using today, even for that matter, to record this. The Chinese have also, I think, encouraged Iran to switch out of, if they haven't yet, the GPS system, you know, which is American dominated. China has its own GPS system. It's called BDS, nothing to do with boycott, divest, sanction. It's Beidou system. So that would allow them to, you know, navigate, to use navigation systems outside of the American system. Russia has its own as well. I think it's a much bigger one, GLONASS. But so they've been loading up on these Chinese sensors and radar systems, which they clearly need. China apparently has also sold Iran these supersonic anti-ship missiles that go at supersonic speed, very close to the water. They're very advanced. We don't know when they're getting them, but China. This goes back, I know Warnard has written about this, going back 10 or 15 years, China has developed
yeah.
some very good anti-missile systems. And for that matter, Iran has some very good ones. Good enough that they're sort of overstock, which they gave to the Houthis, or yeah. at least the technology, that alone almost did in an aircraft carrier. So they have good missiles.
Yeah, the U.S. Navy was very eager to quit
yes,
to the Gulf.
Exit stage left. And the Russians apparently just sold the Iranians a bunch of man pads, Verba man pads. Those are supposed to be pretty good ones. They're very useful against cruise missiles. They're the most advanced man pads that the Russians have made. Good against cruise missiles, which the U.S. still really relies a lot on cruise missiles for these kinds of decapitation and hitting ports and that kind of stuff. Like they still really rely on cruise missiles a lot, but they also would take down copters, the kind of thing that were the U.S. planning to insert special forces somewhere, Verbas would be used against them. I don't know, you know, these are just reports that are coming out. It seems to me kind of strangely, if this is just happening now, I've always wondered, like, why haven't the Chinese, for example, sold the Iranians more? China gets between 20 and 30% of its oil from Iran. So Iran is vital to the Chinese economy. Why? I know that China as a general rule, it's not sort of globally aggressive the way the U.S. is. But you would think, given how aggressive Biden and Trump too have been, like Biden about Taiwan, Biden saying we're going to go to war for Taiwan.
I know you've talked in the past about Russia, a huge oil supplier, switching its oil industry to supply China.
Yes.
So maybe they're safe in that
regard. They're not. Okay. I mean, Russia has moved, you know, is building new pipelines and is moving assets or oil sort of flows that way. But no, they're not safe yet. It takes a while to build out all the pipeline capacity and all the to kind of refigure the whole thing. It's gone much more quickly, I think, than people assumed. But they do need the Iranian oil. Like it would cause a real shock to China. Okay. And on top of that, Trump announced two massive arms packages to Taiwan, just that, you know, within his first year in office. Massive. So it's strange to me that they wouldn't share more. But maybe they have, and maybe a lot of this is on the down low. I don't know. We'll find out. I think at this point we can pretty much wrap it up. I do think people think that it's possible we'll be seeing Trump launching something by this weekend, because it's extremely unlikely that Iran is going to capitulate in the way that Witkoff and Trump want. And then Trump has a credibility problem. And for a guy who's so wrapped up in himself and his madman theory, there's no way he's going to blow his madman theory credibility without pushing a button first, right? I mean.
Yeah, I mean, for one of the few times in recent memory, I really wish I could look at the world as it will be 1 year from now, because yes. Things are just at the starting line, just about to kick off.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume that any U.S. strike, unless it's from the air, long range, mostly automated, will go very badly. But maybe not. I don't know.
No, I feel like you're right. Like, that has not been an assumption. I was kind of trying to say earlier, Trump has gotten kind of lucky. He's on a string of luck.
Yeah.
Nothing has gone badly militarily yet for him. The only thing that has gone badly has been his attempt to force Ukraine and Russia to a peace deal. And, you know, we'll have to do an episode soon about that war, because we just passed the fourth anniversary. And the fact that it's even that fourth anniversary has not been a big deal in our press is part of the story. But you know, with his military actions, he's gotten kind of lucky so far. And as you've pointed out,
a good way to do that is to stick to Venezuela.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. But, and, you know, and as you've pointed out, the war nerds pointed out, going back to the early war nerds, like, nothing is a worse teacher than victories or successes.
Right.
It gets you gambling a little more. And so on that happy note, I think we can end this episode.
Okay.
Thanks again, John. Thanks, Brendan.
Thanks,
Thank you, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Bye.